From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what challenges lie ahead in the new year for Michigan Democrats and Republicans?
When we're dealing with problems and crises, we're not Republicans and Democrats. We're Americans. We want our community. We want our country. We want our state to do well.
Plus, Grand Rapids schools will undergo a major transformation. Tough actions lie ahead.
If, in fact, you have so many people telling you this doesn't feel right, I think you need to listen.
We talk with Grand Rapids School Superintendent Teresa Wetherall Neal, and we follow Wayne State Med students as they reach out to help homeless women and men.
We're all trying to help you out, so.
Okay, I appreciate your help. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Appreciate everything you're doing for me.
All of that and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, Grand Rapids Public Schools are going through a massive transformation plan. We'll talk with the district superintendent about what needs to be done for that city's students. And we'll continue our look at the homeless in Michigan. We'll ride along with a team of medical students and health professionals providing in-the-field medical services for Detroit's homeless. But first, news out of Lansing today. Governor Snyder was presented with Senate Bill 59 this afternoon. This is the bill that would allow people with concealed pistol permits to carry guns in schools and other places. Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief from the Michigan Public Radio Network, has been chasing this story. Rick, you and I spoke just yesterday afternoon. At that point, Governor Snyder said he was still considering whether to sign or veto the measure, and now it's sounding like he's preparing to veto it. What do we know right now?
Oh, everything's done but the shouting that we are still waiting for the official veto letter, but the governor has made clear that he has objections, while this was being negotiated. We're just learning more about them now. And he has informed legislators and legislative leaders that he's going to veto the bill. And so now we're just waiting. As a matter of fact, there was supposed to be a rally of faith leaders at the Capitol this afternoon to protest the bill, urge a veto. And so I imagine that will now be a celebration.
And the events on Friday, I'm sure, he had said that was really reinforcing his thinking.
The governor, we know that there was some heated negotiations about this bill in the waning hours of the legislature's lame duck session, that the governor wanted to have some specific exceptions that allowed schools and daycare centers, places like that, to keep to keep guns out. And the sponsor of the legislation said, no, that's going too far for us. And they agreed to disagree. The legislature sent it to the governor to wait and see what he would do. He said that he had reservations before this, but certainly the events of last week solidified his decision that he was going to veto it. And we should point out, you know, yesterday I checked on this. Yesterday at noon, there were 6,000 plus emails, web messages, phone calls to the governor. By 5-1, people were asking the governor to veto this. Those communications this morning at 9 a.m., 20,000 communications, 70% of the people opposing it saying the governor should veto it.
But Rick, technically right now, Michigan schools are still open carry zones, right? So any adult could walk into a school openly with a gun?
Well, technically, yes. The way Michigan policy works is that we're what's called an open carry state, that you can carry in places where it's not expressly forbidden, subject to things like private property rights. Well, in the case of schools, administrators, principals have, you know, a lot of latitude to determine who can go where and with what in a school. If you've ever, you know, gone in to pick up your kids at school, you know, the person at the office will say, sit there, we'll go and get them. But that doesn't change, that they still have that latitude. But yes, technically, schools are still open carry zones. And the governor said he would like to see something done about that next year.
Keeping an eye on the governor and his veto pen, Rick Pluta, the Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Rick, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
And to Grand Rapids now, where last night, that district school board gave unanimous approval to a major restructuring plan. Superintendent Teresa Weatherall-Neal developed the overhaul to not only save money, but improve student achievement. The so-called transformation plan will close 10 schools, reopen one elementary school, and then streamline and consolidate many programs. The savings are expected to be in the neighborhood of over $20 million. Superintendent Teresa Weatherall-Neal joins us now from Grand Rapids. Superintendent, first give us an overall look. 10 schools slated to be closed under the plan. How many students would this affect?
For 10 schools, that will be about 3,000 students. And we are going to merge a few of the programs. So it really will affect more students than just that. But we're going to work with parents and members of this community to make this a seamless transaction.
What will be happening in terms of layoffs?
You know, I'm not real sure. We are going to lose some staff members. However, I will try to keep that at a minimum because I don't want to increase class size. That is not the goal. But we will lose some of our staff members, absolutely.
Why is right now the right time to make such significant adjustments to Grand Rapids schools?
I am a public administrator by trade, and I do believe in choice. And I think that as parents begin to make more and more choices, we really need to focus on great opportunities for students. And I don't think we can wait. I think the time is right now.
The district has really been through a lot of turmoil in the last couple of years with the former superintendent had rolled out that blended learning model with the more online options in hub schools about 2 or 3 years ago. And then there was a dramatic exit that brought you and your team in January. So we're wondering, do you worry that you'll lose the confidence of parents and students with so much change in direction in a short time frame?
You know, I don't. I have received a lot of support from this community, and the goal is to stabilize this district for the next few years. We have been through a lot, but we have also made a lot of gains, and we are planning to just continue to move forward.
What ideas of Bernard Taylor's, if any, have you kept and invested in?
You know, Dr. Taylor did quite a bit for this district. I was a member of his cabinet, and technology, he did bring that to the forefront. Technology is still extremely important. It's just the way we go about doing it. And he has also worked very closely with our community, and I think that's very important, and I plan to continue that.
Speaking of working with the community, you're getting great praise for the way you did listen to the community. Talk to us more about that, because I'm wondering what kind of lessons other districts could learn from your approach.
I think a couple of things. One, I'm a product of this community, and I came in saying that I don't own the school district. I have just been very blessed to lead this district, but I think that you have to keep a process that's open enough that you can listen to the community and allow people to have a voice. The school systems really does belong to the community, not to one person sitting in a seat.
There are some Grand Rapids public schools that are on the state's lowest performing list. Union High School's in serious danger of a state takeover because it's been on the list for 3 years in a row. Do you know what's not working at Union or the other schools that this plan might help with?
I don't know quite what's not working, but what I do know is I am committed to working with the schools to get them off of the list. I've created a governance board, and then I also was the lead person for Burton Middle School, and I got that school off the list. It was on the list for 9 years, actually, and I led a team through a process of 2 years to close that achievement gap, and they have not been on the list since.
What happened? What did they do to close that gap?
One was we focused strictly on data. We allowed the data to drive the plan, and we had mid-course corrections. We worked with parents, and I did get a new team of teachers and secretaries and principals in.
And what did that new team bring? Because I'm real interested in what other parents and other school administrators might learn from what you've been able to do in closing that gap.
You know, sometimes it's just bringing in some new people to change the mix just enough to give it a new breath of life, and I think that's one of the things. The other is we had to ensure that the curriculum was actually being taught. We made sure that students were prepared when they came to school to learn, because it's not just teaching, but students need to be prepared. So we worked with parents, we gave them tools, and we were in the school every week to look at data and to change, if necessary, what we were doing.
What would you say, Superintendent, to parents, to students, and even to the neighbors who are facing the shutdown of schools that really have become a key part of their lives? I'm sure there are very, very high emotions, and it's hard to rule with the head when your heart is hurting. What do you say to them, and how do you answer them?
I think the first is I would like for everyone to know that I believe in their students. I believe in this district. I believe that I am the person to make a change, and I want to partner with them. But it will be a partnership. It isn't something that I can do alone. The other thing is we need to be positive. We all need to be held accountable for our role, whether that's a student, a parent, a superintendent. Everyone needs to be held accountable for the work they should be doing.
What would you like, or what do you think that other Michigan school districts and their leaders can really learn from the way that you've developed this transformation plan and your hopes for Grand Rapids schools?
I think one is to be very open, and I don't think you can just be open with the parents and the students and the staff members that are directly connected with the district, but I think you have to open up to the entire community because the community owns the schools. And if, in fact, you have so many people telling you this doesn't feel right, I think you need to listen.
What's next? I mean, looking ahead, what else is on your plate and what other goals do you have for Grand Rapids Public Schools?
The very next thing is to put together a process so that we can, one, close schools, open schools, and work with the community. We have a lot of heavy lifting to do beginning the first of the year, and I would ask that people stay involved, believe in what we are doing, we as a community. But most importantly, I say hold us accountable.
I'm curious. You're in a hot seat. There's no doubt. You're in a hot seat.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like? How do you keep focused when there's such a chorus of voices demanding this and wanting that? What's the key to keeping your eye on the prize, if it will, and staying the course?
And actually, you answered it. You know, it really is staying focused on children. I have been so blessed in this community to be a part of the district. I've been with the district now for almost 50 years, since I was 4 years old. And I can do this work and stay focused on children. I try not to get involved in adult issues. That's hard, but that's the only thing that we can do.
And just so we're clear, where will the students be going from the schools that are closed, Superintendent?
We are in the process of reboundering all of our schools, and we would like to offer them a choice. But I want to offer them a choice of excellent schools in every neighborhood, not five or six theme schools. Those are great. But you should be able to walk across the street or walk around the corner and have the same awesome education and opportunity that you would have in the other schools.
Grand Rapids Public Schools Superintendent Teresa Weatherall Neal, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you for allowing me to do this.
Still to come, Great Grandpa takes a walk on the wild side. We'll get an unusual history lesson about a party-filled pleasure cruise that took tourists from Chicago to South Haven 100 years ago. That's in 15 minutes here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Continuing our series now, exploring just what it means to be homeless in Michigan. Today, we talk about health care. Let's say you get sick. These days, if you're lucky enough to have health insurance, you pick up the phone, make a call, schedule an appointment with your doctor, and off you go. But an illness or an injury can have huge consequences for someone who's homeless. A new program in Detroit is tackling this issue by providing street medicine, a traveling team of medical students and health professionals meeting homeless people on their own turf and providing in-the-field, on-the-fly medical care. Michigan Radio's Kyle Norris reports.
Several Wayne State University students started Street Medicine Detroit back in May. They'd heard about a similar program in Pittsburgh, and they were inspired. They partnered with a Detroit nonprofit called NSO. It's Neighborhood Service Organization. And together, they created a mobile medical clinic. We're going to meet those med students in a minute. But first, meet Philip Ramsey.
I've heard a lot about this guy. Mr. Ramsey? I'm Kyle.
He's a community outreach specialist with NSO. Rumor has it that if you're trying to locate a specific homeless person and you give Ramsey the vaguest of details, he can go out and find that person who might be living in a tent next to the highway. Once a week, the med team piles into a big brown van with Ramsey behind the wheel. Ramsey navigates the team around the back alleys and streets of Detroit.
And you're just going to drive down the street and shout out the window if you see some...
Well, that's sort of what we do, but we know where they stay and where they be, so we go to an area where we can find them at.
The van rumbles down Michigan Avenue, past prostitutes on the corners, and a young man pushing a baby stroller. Ramsey says he's looking for people lying down on the ground or who are sitting on the curb, maybe drinking with dirty clothes and uncombed hair. The van pulls up to a liquor store, drives to the back near the dumpster, and comes up to two men and one woman sitting on the curb.
Hello.
They live in a tent behind the store.
I got mail for them.
The mail comes to you guys and
yeah,
you hook them up.
They have an address, so they use the NSO road home for the address. Now, these guys got their voting registration card, so they can vote now, too.
Hey, I get to vote.
That is Mr. Harris. He's a homeless man who asked I only use his last name. The medical team pops out of the van. It consists of Wayne State University medical students, and their group leader is Dean Carpenter. He's a nurse practitioner at a homeless center run by the nonprofit NSO. The medical team has seen Harris several times in the field, and they're treating him for a urinary tract infection. So Carpenter asks Harris how he's doing after taking an antibiotic.
Those half pills?
Yeah, I still got them.
Do you feel better on it?
I feel the same.
Still the same. So
I feel the same, but, you know, I'm not going to the bathroom.
Carpenter turns to his students and fills them in on Harris's medical history, which includes heavy drinking.
So I think his liver is starting to get some damage.
Liver's starting to get some damage?
Yeah, your liver's taking a hit.
Carpenter tells Harris they need to get him into housing before the winter and think about getting him treatment. There are three big health issues that the medical team sees homeless people struggle with. One is a physical health condition. Second is a severe mental illness. And the third, substance abuse. If a homeless person has all three of these things, or what's called the trifecta, it puts them at risk of dying sooner rather than later, especially during the winter. Sal Callow is one of the medical students. He bends down next to Harris and sits alongside him to take his blood pressure.
My name's Sal, by the way.
Who?
My name's Sal.
S-A-L?
S-A-L, that's right.
Wow, Sal. I know a couple Sals. A little Seal and a Sal.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Can you turn your arm outside? Thank you, sir.
No,
there's a tenderness between these two guys who are sitting side by side, but they're also joking around. Callow says people often open up to you and tell you what they're worried about when you take their blood pressure.
Am I dead? Dead man walking?
Harris just asked if he was a dead man walking. Meanwhile, another student begins taking a history of Harris. The student asks him if he drinks, and Harris says yes, one pint of vodka every day. Harris also says his legs are swelling, but the team does not know what's causing the swelling. Student Sal Callow tells Harris they want to find out, but they're going to need resources to do that. Specifically, they need to get Harris insured through Medicaid.
We're all trying to help you out, so.
Okay, I appreciate your help. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Appreciate everything you're doing for me.
Hey, man. I'm glad to.
Invite me to a graduation party when you graduate. You go to Wayne State.
Establishing relationships is a big goal of this program. The idea is to ultimately rope people into getting housing and services. The med team is also targeting a specific population of homeless people, those who do not get services because they don't trust or like or feel comfortable with formal establishments. For one person today, the mobile medical clinic made a difference. This man would not give me his name, but he said the mobile clinic recently helped him connect with some services back at the homeless center and get pills for his diabetes. Here he is with his fiancée in the van as Ramsey drives them from the center to the house that they're squatting in.
I got my pills. I got my ID. I got an appointment tomorrow to go for my PTSD, go see my doctor, to get my other pills. Then the housing, too. I'm a veteran, and they're going to hook me up with an apartment.
And this is all, like, in day one, right?
It's within half a day.
My sense is you're a little surprised about that. Is that true, or?
Oh, I'm like, wow, people care. I mean, I woke up this morning, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And now I got light at the end of the tunnel.
Now you got some hope.
Yep. At this point in the van, I'm sitting behind this guy, and he's sitting next to his fiance. Seemed like a tough guy. Probably didn't cry a whole lot, and I could tell, even though I was behind him, that tears were running down his face. The Wayne State medical students are trying to raise money for equipment and medicine, and also to create an additional weekend shift. They hope their efforts will help prevent homeless people from overusing things like the emergency room, hospital visits, and going to psychiatric crisis centers. As for Harris, the guy the med team saw behind the liquor store, well, in November, he suffered a cardiac arrest. He's conscious, but he can't talk. He's about to be transferred from a hospital to an extended care facility. For Stateside, I'm Kyle Norris.
You can find out more information about this program online at streetmedicinedetroit.org or go to our website, michiganradio.org. This story was informed by the Public Insight Network. We'd like to hear from you. Has homelessness affected your life? In what way? Tell us your story. Find us on our Facebook page. That's Stateside with Cynthia Canty. Or on Twitter. We're at Stateside Radio. When you think back to what life was like in, oh, let's say 1910, and what people did for fun, chances are pretty good you conjure up images of ice cream socials, sedate teas, or picnics, all very demure. Well, you would be so wrong. When it came to getting up to creative mischief and taking a walk on the proverbial wild side, it seems that folks at the turn of the 20th century might be able to teach us a thing or two. And you need look no further than the hugely popular steamships. They took tourists from Chicago to South Haven on Michigan's west coast. Historian Larry Massey did exactly that, and the title of his article in last month's Encore magazine says it all, Lake Michigan's Floating Gomorrah. Larry, tell us why steamships like the City of South Haven were floating Gomorrahs.
Well, South Haven itself was very dry. There were no taverns whatsoever. Van Buren County teetotalers had voted under a local option law that the whole county would be about as dry as the surrounding sand dunes. So they couldn't get a drink in South Haven, and this was an era when South Haven was a mecca for tourists, primarily from Chicago, and these great big steamships carried thousands and thousands of passengers back and forth for the resorts of South Haven. And on board, it was totally different from what it was like in South Haven. Anything went. And what had happened was, 600 ministers in Chicago had gotten together and had decided they wanted to do something about the social evil in Chicago, where there were prostitutions, red light districts, and all sorts of illegal drinking, underage drinking and things like that, white slave trade. And so they approached the mayor of Chicago, and he said, well, Chicago's no worse than any other city, but he did allow them to form a vice council and allocated $5,000 for their work in investigating this. Well, I happened to be in an antiquarian bookstore where I do a lot of snooping around, and I saw this volume called The Social Evil in Chicago. Now, what red-blooded lad would not pull down a title like that?
Absolutely.
So I was thumbing through it, probably looking for pictures, which there were none, and I came across a chapter about these ships that were going back and forth from South Haven to Chicago and what was going on in them.
And this we have context, we're talking pretty much turn of the century?
We're talking, the book was published in 1911, the Vice Council was formed in 1910. And that $5,000 they allocated toward hiring a lot of what like today we'd call them private detectives. They call them investigators.
Undercover.
Undercover. And one of these investigators went aboard five different vessels that went from Chicago to South Haven in the summer of 1910 and made a report of what he or she found. We don't know the name of the investigator because they kept that undercover as well.
Huh. So what kinds of goings-on did these investigators find?
Well, I will read from one of the reports.
Okay.
In stateroom number 66 were four men. Two girls visited the room during the night. In number 61, there was one girl. She was visited by four men at different times. Number 69 was occupied by two girls and two young men. In number 21, three men and three girls were in the lower berth.
Good heavens.
In the bar room, about 20 young girls were drinking beer, five of them not over 12 years of age. One child, 8 years old, was drinking beer with older people.
Hmm. Now, it's kind of interesting, as these are being described, very, very detailed, and one has to wonder, how did that investigator find out there were four people in the lower berth? Stick his head in the room? Or
you would wonder. Maybe, I think he or she was prowling the hallways quite a bit.
I would say.
Because later on, even more graphic descriptions.
And certainly not what we'd expect from 1910. Was it, how long was the voyage over?
It took about 5 hours to go from South Haven to Chicago and vice versa.
So a lot of mischief could be gotten up to in those 5 hours.
There was. And, you know, there were about five different steamships operating in 1910. And they they tried to hide the names of the different steamships, but they gave some internal information which allowed me to realize, hey, this is the city of South Haven, mm-hmm. by the number of passengers aboard and the length of the ship and things like that. And during that 5 hours, the city of South Haven in particular had a dance band and a big dance floor, and it had several saloons right on board, so people could have a really good time. They called it the Saturday Evening Mid-Lake Frolic.
The Saturday Evening Mid-Lake Frolic, and it does sound like there was a lot of frolicking going on.
There was a lot of frolicking.
Well, now, could they control, really, with it being out on the lake, what could the Vice Commission do, or what could
they couldn't do anything, really. There were no regulations for what went on aboard the steamships at that time. But they were worried about Chicago people being influenced by this Bacchanalian revelry that was going on board the ship, and perhaps getting introduced to something that would tempt them.
Okay.
They realized, the investigator reported, that there were prostitutes aboard, that there were men that were looking to kind of coerce women into the white slave trade, become prostitutes. And then there were like innocent couples who were unmarried, had gone over to South Haven for a weekend, and because of the ready atmosphere of all this drinking and the availability of staterooms, that they could be,
tempted
by the devil itself.
So this report was written, and your article, Larry Massey, we're talking with historian Larry Massey, who wrote an article for the November issue of Encore magazine that is entitled Lake Michigan's Floating Gomorrah. Larry, your article seems to draw a pretty direct connection between the findings of the Chicago Vice Commission about these wild times people are having on Lake Michigan and perhaps ultimately the Volstead Act and Prohibition in 1919.
Well, yeah. One of the direct consequences of the publication of this report was Chicago had a big red light district that they had just allowed to happen, you know. Everybody knew about it, the police knew about it, but they just kept it open.
Okay.
The following year, in 1912, they closed it down.
Okay.
However, about a month later, it opened up again. And so periodically, over the next, 20 years, they'd close it down, and it'd be closed for a month or two, and then it'd open up again, back and forth. And then I'm assuming that this volume went through four editions in a year of thousands of copies, and so it was all around, and it had to have had an effect on the temperance movement, and which resulted in 1919 a passage of the Volstead Act, which gave us 15 years of no booze in this country.
And that led to a lot of widespread social ills, such as
the rise of the underworld. Because, let's face it, when you attempt to legislate morality, people are going to find a way around that.
Yeah.
And they certainly did. This was the rum-running era and the speakeasies and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And certainly Detroit had a big part of that, Chicago.
It did.
And anyone who's watching Boardwalk Empire right now, as we are, certainly know, you kind of see that underside of what happened during Prohibition.
Sure.
So I'm kind of curious, as you read all of this and you came to this awareness that these tourists in 1910 and 1911 were going back and forth and having high old times on Lake Michigan, Larry, what do you think this says about what our great-grandparents really were like?
Well, this is the kind of thing that didn't get put in print very often, what people were really like. But you can read between the lines. And let's face it, Cynthia, people are people. And you can read the Bible and find out that the biblical characters were influenced by the same sorts of things that we are, and
yeah.
The people in Shakespeare and the people in the 19th century. And so this just shows that everybody is a human being, and the human nature will out.
It will. It certainly will. Well, ultimately, what was the fate of the steamships going back and forth? When did this kind of die out?
Well, I'm not sure when the iniquity died out, but
it may not have yet.
Yeah, there's still yachts going out.
That's right.
Well, the steamships continued to run until the 1930s, and then because of the all the automobile more or less run them out of business. And so you don't see these big palatial steamers capable of carrying 3,000 people anymore.
Now we just fly to Miami and take a cruise
right,
and go
right.
from there. Larry Massey is the author. Fascinating article in the November 2012 issue of Encore, Lake Michigan's Floating Gomorra. Thanks for talking with us, Larry.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And you can find a link to Larry's story. It's fascinating reading. Just go to our website at michiganradio.org. Now we know Grandpa was having just a little more fun than we thought when he was listening to this music. Still to come, we're going to be joined by two big players in the state's Democratic and Republican parties. We'll talk lame duck aftermath and fiscal cliff consequences. That's next on Stateside. We'll be right back. So the lame duck session is over in Lansing, and as state lawmakers take a holiday breather, there's little doubt they're thinking about and planning for next month when there will be some new faces in the state house for the new year. And even further out to 2014, that's when all the seats in both the state house and Senate are up for election, along with Governor Rick Snyder, Attorney General Bill Schuette, Secretary of State Ruth Johnson, and Michigan's entire congressional delegation. Let's talk to a couple of key players in the Democratic and Republican parties in Michigan about what both parties should focus on and should do to gear up for the new year. Saul Anuzis is the former chairman of the Michigan Republican Party. He's joining us from New York. And Debbie Dingell is a Democratic National Committee woman and president of D2 Strategies. And she joins us from Washington. Welcome to you both.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Good to have you. Let's talk about the last few weeks here in Michigan and the lame duck legislature and that fast pace with right to work and abortion and guns among the bills that were passed very quickly and very little or no public debate or comment. Did that hurt the GOP, Debbie?
Well, I think it did. I think that people in Michigan were stunned by many of the bills that passed so quickly without discussion. We still don't at this time know what the outcome is going to be on some of them, what pieces of legislation the governor is going to sign or not sign. And he himself said that there were so many changes at the last minute, he doesn't know what was in them and he wants to study them. But I think a lot of people were surprised by the broad scope of some very dramatic actions, and it's causing people to sit back and think and really look at the year 2014. And by the way, a year that I would have, right after the election, said, hey, this is going to be a Republican year, has made it a competitive race.
Well, I think it will be a competitive year. I mean, look, the lame duck session every 2 years is something where a lot of bills move very quickly. It's when they clean up legislation that's been sitting on the table for a long time. And I don't think anybody was surprised. I mean, we've been talking about right to work for years. You know, the abortion bills and other bills. I mean, there was a lot of things that were on the table. A lot of things got passed. Some will get signed, some won't. But I think this is part of the process, and we're going to move forward, and Michigan will be better for it.
You know, we had people say, observers, longtime political observers say, never, ever had they seen the kind of pace and the kind of action from lame duck with over 250 bills and some of them extremely tempestuous, extremely emotional, that were really jammed through. So it really wasn't a business as it wasn't a typical lame duck, was it, Saul?
I don't think that's true. I mean, you know, I served 12 years in the Michigan legislature as a chief of staff to Dick Potsdamer. And I remember still sitting there Christmas Eve evening passing bills. So, I mean, this is what happens in lame duck. This is why many people don't like lame duck. I don't think it's necessarily good for the process. But to somehow pretend or, you know, think that we're shocked and surprised that something like this happened, I think is just not fair. And I think it's being used politically for people to kind of get a shock value out of it. But the reality is, this isn't the best way to pass public policy. It's not the best way to have legislation done, but it is a political reality, and it's happened since, I started back in 1981, 82, and it's happened every year since then.
Debbie, how bothered and how rattled were you as you were watching what was happening in Lansing?
Well, I sort of felt like I just finished post-traumatic stress when I headed back to Washington on Friday night, having not seen my husband for 10 days, because I was in Michigan watching all of this. And I think that people were shocked and stunned by the rapidity and number of social issues that were addressed without hearings, the number of issues that were taken up that will have dramatic impact upon the citizens of Michigan for years to come if they're not turned around in 2 years in another election where the state legislature may change hands over the feelings of a number of these issues. Certainly, so right to work, which only a week before it passed, the governor had continued to say, as well as the Senate Majority Leader, that this issue wasn't on their agenda. That surprised the nation. Now, I had warned people that I had thought that that was coming, and I was very focused on that. But to see the women's issues that were discussed, we don't even know everything that they were voting on. There weren't copies of the bills. You had to be listening and talk to people that were allowed on the floor to even know what was in these bills that were being passed.
Sounds like Obamacare, huh?
No, Obamacare, people had copies and people talked about it, and they knew what the issues were.
Oh, yeah.
But that's a favorite line of the Republicans. But I think that Republicans played out those that didn't like the health care bill. They had a legitimate forum. They brought it up in the presidential election. The people voted, and we're going to see that health care go into play. Now, these next 2 years, we'll see many of the issues that were discussed and voted on very quickly in that last week, really, about a week's worth of activity, passing, as you say, more than 250 pieces of legislation. As people become aware of what did happen, you'll see people engaged.
The protests that we saw, particularly on the Thursday and then the following Tuesday over right to work, I'd like both of your thoughts on what we were seeing, one of the biggest protests ever on the steps of the Capitol. Do you think the bad taste is going to linger in the public's mouth, or will voters kind of forget about all of that by the next time the next election rolls around?
Well, I'm not sure people are going to forget. I mean, I think this is what democracy is all about. I think it was great that people showed up on the steps of the Capitol and expressed their opinions. I think that there's a lot of misinformation as to what right to work has to do with. All it does is give workers a choice of whether or not they want to belong to a union. So I think as we discuss the issues, I think as people understand that that's all it is, that it doesn't take away collective bargaining, that it doesn't take away unions' rights to exist, that it just gives workers a choice, I think it's not going to be as dominant of an issue. But this was very important for the union leadership. It was very important for the Democratic Party to fire up their base. It's good politics. I understand it from their perspective. But I think in the end, right to work will be good for Michigan. It does not drop wages. If you take a look at the national average, you're talking about on average 3% less. But it increases employment. It has more people working for a living. And if you take out the union dues, I think that 3% drops to pretty close to a break even. So I think in the long run, this will be good for Michigan. It'll be good for Michigan jobs. It'll be good for our economy.
Well, I obviously disagree with Saul. What I fear the most is how it is. I don't believe it'll go away before the next election. And I think the tension that we're going to see in this state is something that really bothers me. I think we have made tremendous progress in the last decades of business and labor working together, understanding the partnership and the criticalness of both of them to successful businesses, to attracting business, to working together. I think that trust was literally eliminated in a week. I spoke to people the weekend before they were going up to Lansing, and I can't tell you, from union halls to churches to the beauty parlor to the grocery store, school teachers who told me they were taking the day off because they were going to Lansing because they knew that this was a personal attack on them. The people that normally served as marshals when you have these kinds of things, saying that they weren't going to do it this time because they didn't want to not be able to say what they thought, how deeply disturbed they were. One of the things that I keep saying to people is whatever you do in the next 2 years, we can't hurt Michigan. And we've got to find ways to keep moving ourselves forward with also understanding what this issue is about. The unions have helped create the middle class in this country. They have brought economic stability to working men and women, and many people who aren't even in unions have benefited from what has been negotiated at that contract table. I disagree respectfully. I have a great deal of respect for Saul that the states that have right to work have a less income. Fewer people are covered by health insurance. The top 10 states who are the most successful are not, for the most part, right to work states. I just don't want to see people pitted against each other. We all need to work together.
Let me just add, I think that there's no reason that labor and business and the state and everything else will not continue to work together, because the unions aren't going away. There's not going to be an elimination of workers. The UAW is still going to be there representing the big three, and all the other unions are still going to be there. It's just that individual workers who may or may not agree with some of the politics or other policies of the unions are going to have a choice not to belong to a union. So if we don't kind of get into the hyperbole of all this, if we don't let the political fever take it away, I think the reality is we will work together, we'll move forward, and Michigan has a very bright future because of it, and I think we just have to treat it fairly calmly and honestly, and we'll be in good shape.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we're talking to a couple of key players in the Democratic and Republican parties in our state about what each party should be focusing on and doing to gear up for the new year coming in. Saul Anuzis, the former chairman of the Michigan Republican Party, and Debbie Dingell, Democratic National Committee woman and president of D2 Strategies. And right now we've been having a conversation about the effect of right to work, in particular that vote. I'm wondering what both of you think about the position of Governor Rick Snyder from going from the it's not on my agenda, it's too divisive, it sucks the air out of the room, to all right, I'll sign it. And it was seen by just about everybody as a very sudden about face. Saul, what price do you think Governor Snyder will pay for doing that?
Well, I'm not sure he'll pay a price. I mean, I think clearly, as Debbie has pointed out, I think it's going to motivate many Democrats. It's going to motivate many union members. But I'm not sure they weren't already motivated and weren't coming out to work and coming out to work on behalf of elections. And so in that regard, I'm not sure it's going to have a big effect. I think that, you know, in the end, Governor Snyder is going to be judged on his successes, on the policies and what happens in Michigan. And I think as the economy, you know, moves forward, I think as he helps turn things around, I mean, for all practical purposes, this has been a fairly moderate governor across the board. He is very Michigan-like. He very much fits into, kind of the mindset that finding the common ground and middle ground. And so, you know, there's always going to be issues that you disagree with. But I think that the governor has surprised a lot of people, has worked very well with both sides of the aisle and people across the board from an industry standpoint. You know, he's a lot more moderate than I would have liked or I would have preferred, but I think that in general he's probably more representative of what the state as a whole is like.
Well, I have to respectfully disagree. I agree with much of what Saul just said, but I think that his move stunned people. They believe that what he did for the conservative wing of the Republican Party, and that his relentless positive energy is not perceived that way by many people now. I think he had been, a lot of people had begun to become charmed by him almost. I talked to many people at the national level who really did view him as perhaps one of a real moderate that was able to work with people on both sides of the aisle, was trying to find common ground. I believe that in moving the right to work legislation, they feel that he is really not interested in finding that common ground. If people really believed that this is what the people of Michigan wanted, why didn't they take it and let the people vote on it? Why was it not done as a ballot proposal? I think that a lot of the trust that he had begun to build potentially with some of the labor unions is just flat out absolutely gone. And I fear that the next 2 years are going to be far more turbulent than I had hoped or wanted to see.
Yeah, but I think it's also too bad that, you know, because of one issue, we're going to have this. I mean, let's remember, 24 states are right-to-work states. The average state that still is a non-right-to-work state only has about 14% of their working members as part of a union. Again, this is not going to eliminate unions. Most of the right-to-work states continue to have unions in their state at different levels. So, again, I think this is a little bit of an overblown issue for political purposes. And, again, I understand it and I get it. But I think as we move forward, I think the people of Michigan are going to see that it doesn't have as big of an effect as people think. No one's going to get worse working conditions. No one's going to lose their health care. Time will heal many wounds, and I think we're going to, you know, be in a position to move forward unless, for political purposes, people want to use a single issue as a dividing issue, which would be unfortunate.
I want to turn to the Democratic Party and get your thoughts. Does everything that happened, all these things that we've been talking about over the last couple of weeks, does it fundamentally help or hurt Democrats politically?
Well, right now, I think it's helping them. I mean, it's motivating their base. They're pulling their folks together. And for those of us who are involved in politics on either side, you know, your base is an important part of the game, so to speak. So you need your volunteers, you need your donors, you need the people who are active on a day-to-day basis. So from that standpoint, I think the party as a political organization is probably currently being helped and motivated as their base is fired up about these issues.
And your view, Debbie?
Well, I agree with what Saul said, but again, I think both parties have this great innate ability to shoot themselves in the foot and not do what they need to do, to not take and do lessons learned for reflection. Democrats made serious mistakes in this last election, especially at the state level. And I think both Republicans and Democrats need to do serious soul-searching, look at what was right, look at what was wrong, and what they have to do differently. The party that's best able to learn and put together a strategy and an organization for 2014 is the party that will win. I sincerely hope it's going to be Democrats, but I think it has yet to be seen which one of us will do a better job at it.
Debbie, what mistakes, serious mistakes, do you feel the Democrats made?
Well, this is not a secret, so I believe from the very beginning we should not have had the number of ballot proposals that were on the ballot. I think that they needed to prioritize what was the most important, and that when you have that large a ballot, people are going to be inclined to vote no. So that while each of the issues on the ballot was important to somebody and were important issues, they all got voted down, which wasn't to anybody's benefit. You also have to look at where the money was spent. Did they focus on the right things? Electing state legislatures needs to be a key priority. Republicans have done a very good job at electing legislators, and you see it in the House and Senate.
In our final moments, I'd love your thoughts on just in general for both parties. It seems that the American public is very disappointed, unhappy, especially looking at the fiscal cliff bargaining that people hope is going on between President Obama and House Speaker Boehner. What do you both feel that both parties need to do to win back the trust or the belief of so many disaffected American voters?
Well, Saul and I are good friends. Mm-hmm. I think the American people want to see people get along. And when we're dealing with problems and crises, we're not Republicans and Democrats. We're Americans. We want our community. We want our country. We want our state to do well. And I think the American people want that. I think they're tired of the bickering. I think they're scared to death about the country's future. We do need to reduce the spending in this country, but there's certain things we need. So how do we find a balance that everybody can work together so that we've got a future that's promising for everybody?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with Debbie. I think that the problem we have is that rather than looking for the common ground, there's always the issue, whether it's right to work or anything else, that divides us. Even though Debbie and I could sit down tomorrow and move forward with respect to working for the betterment of Michigan and the betterment of our country, there will still be very fundamental issues that we're on opposite sides on. The trick is, can we respectfully do that with one another, understanding our, you know, philosophical differences, our political differences, and when available or when properly put forward, to set those aside and do what's best for the state or the country. That's a very unique and, unfortunately, a fleeting moment in politics these days. There are not enough people who are willing to sit down and talk to the other side of the aisle. There are not enough people who can walk down the street and give each other a hug and a kiss and wish each other, you know, Merry Christmas and a Happy Holidays. Instead, there's a lot of bitterness. There's a lot of political divide out there that doesn't serve us very well in the long term. But unfortunately, that's the environment we're in the short term. And those of us who are willing to sit down and work together are going to have to step up and probably lead by example rather than just rhetoric we're lucky enough to have right now on the radio. Looking forward to giving Debbie a hug and a kiss.
There you go.
Same here.
Send it. Put a picture up on Facebook, okay?
We'll do that for you.
We will. We see each other.
Sala News is the former chairman of the Michigan Republican Party, and Debbie Dingell, president of D2 Strategies and Democratic National Committee woman. Happy holidays to both of you, and thanks for joining us on Stateside.
Thank you, and peace for everybody in 2013.
Great to be with you. Thank you very much.
And a quick update for all of you. Now, we have word that Governor Rick Snyder has indeed gone ahead and vetoed Senate Bill 59, the bill that would have allowed people with concealed pistol permits to carry guns in schools and other places. More detailed news is online for you at michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered today by Bob Scott. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.